Scripture reading today is from Matthew 25, verses 31 through 36. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me."
In Matthew 24, the immediately preceding chapter, for those of you that are limited on your math knowledge, Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple of Jerusalem. And his disciples are shocked. His disciples cannot imagine that that would be the case, because in the way that they had been taught the Old Testament, the temple was supposed to last forever, and if any temple was going to last forever, it was this one. The one that Herod was in the process of rebuilding was just unbelievable. And the very idea that it could be destroyed, especially when the Messiah was here, was faith-shattering. But Jesus basically says, it's going to happen. Here's how it's going to happen. Get over it. What you really need to be worried about is what it's like to live faithfully to God when the temple's gone. You need to know what it means to live as a person of God in the kingdom of God between the time of the destruction of the temple and when Jesus returns. And that's what Matthew 25 is all about. Matthew 25 is talking about what is life like in the interim. What is a life like in this space we have between the death, burial, and resurrection, the destruction of the temple, and when Jesus returns? And although he doesn't ask the question in Matthew, this question comes in the Gospel of Luke, I think Matthew 25 is answering this question. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? And so Jesus in Matthew 25 is telling his disciples through story how to imagine life in the interim. And we're going to have, first off, a wedding story. And I am pretty sure that wedding stories have been around ever since weddings have. I try not to do very many people's weddings, but I have yet to perform the perfect wedding. And there are always strange things that happen. There are people who dress up like gorillas and attend. Or had one case where the bride was so nervous that she overdosed on her anxiety medication, and when it came time for her to say, "I do," she could not verbalize anything, and so the maid of honor just pulled her head so that she nodded. Well, Jesus is going to tell a funny wedding story. He says, there was this wedding, and there were five wise bridesmaids. And they're wise because they understand that even though the wedding has been set for a year, and even though normally things progress very well, because this is a business deal, okay, weddings in the first century were business deals between the father of the bride and the groom, it was possible on the very day of the wedding for there to be renegotiations of the contract. And the wise bridesmaids know that they need to be prepared for that. So they have their lanterns and they're filled with oil, but they've brought extra oil just in case somebody tries to renegotiate the contract. And we've got five foolish bridesmaids who say, you know, this has been set for a year. Hardly ever are there renegotiations of contracts. This has been something settled between two families for quite some time. We're just going to bring our lamps with the oil that's in them. And Jesus says, well, this wedding was different. This wedding was delayed because the contracts were going to be renegotiated, and it took time, and in fact, all of the bridesmaids fall asleep. But finally, a deal has been reached. It's announced that now we're going to go forward with the wedding, and the bridesmaids wake up, and the foolish bridesmaids don't have any oil left. And they, of course, want the wise bridesmaids to share their oil. And they're going, no, we don't have enough for all of us to participate in this in the way it is. You go find somebody. Yeah, right. In the middle of the night, you're going to find somebody selling oil. 7-Elevens did not exist back then. And so the foolish bridesmaids run off. Now, one of the things that's interesting about how Jesus tells parables is that often he throws in unexpected twists, and that's exactly what we have in this story. I mean, up to now, it's just a funny wedding story. It'd be something that they'd go home, the disciples would go home and tell their wives and say, hey, Jesus told this really funny story about this wedding. But then Jesus talks about the irritated groom. It says, when those foolish bridesmaids finally get oil and they come back to the wedding, they're going to want in to celebrate. After all, this is going to be a week-long party. After all, this is part of the honoring of the bride. And yet the response of the groom is highly unexpected. It's not just go away. It is go away, I don't know you. I don't know who you are. And what Jesus is doing is he's taking a story that people would be really interested in, a story that people would resonate with, and then all of a sudden turning it in a direction so that they can start to think about, okay, maybe Jesus is talking about more than just weddings. Maybe Jesus is talking about the kingdom of God. And what Jesus is doing is saying, guys, I'm getting ready to leave. And my departure may be for quite a while. It's certainly going to be after the destruction of the temple, but you don't know when I'm coming back. And I want you to be wise about your time. Don't think that God works on your timetable. God works on his own timetable. I like to think of God more as an Italian train engineer than a Swiss one. Swiss trains are always on time, within a minute, unless something horrible has happened. You can look at the train schedule in Switzerland and know exactly when to get on the train that you are looking for. In Italy, if the train shows up within 24 hours, it's on time. God has a different timetable. I mean, I would love for God to come back today, and I'm going to be thrilled if he does, but it's not my timing that God cares about. It's his timing. And so Jesus uses this very simple story to try and get the disciples to think about God's timing is very, very different. Imagine these disciples, they're expecting any day now for Jesus to go to Jerusalem. He's going to enter into the temple. He's going to sit on a gold throne, and there's going to be six silver thrones on his right and six silver thrones on his left. And the apostles are going to be sitting on those thrones and ruling Israel. They have in their minds exactly how this is supposed to play out. And Jesus is saying, it may not be like your Sabbath school teacher said it would be. Sometimes the flannel graphs are wrong. Pay attention to God. The next story is about fiscal responsibility, resources, and taking care of those resources. And Jesus is the rich landowner that is going away on a journey, and he's distributing his property, his possessions among his servants. And then he tells his servants that they have a responsibility over what he is passing on to them. And it's very important that we see that when Jesus is passing on this responsibility in the story, right, he gives to each according to his ability. He's not asking too much. The landowner, vaguely Jesus, knows the capacity of his disciples and is giving them responsibilities accordingly. But even more so, according to the generosity of God. One of the more unfortunate translations in the history of English Bible translation is the translation of the word talent in Matthew 25. Your newer English versions will have various other monetary amounts. Probably one of the best translations is bags of gold. But what is being distributed in this story, and this is another little twist of Jesus, the amount of money that's being distributed is the amount of the gross national product of a small nation in the first century. This isn't just some guy going off on a journey. This is one extremely wealthy individual handing over the income of an entire nation for a year. A talent is not your ability to sing and dance. It is 70 pounds of gold. And if we were to put that into monetary terms today, that would be $3,876,925. That's just one talent. Nearly 4 million, one talent. The two-talent guy, nearly 8 million. The five-talent guy, nearly 20 million. God's generosity, but also his expectations. This isn't the only twist in the story that what we're dealing with are just unheard amounts of money for the people that Jesus is talking to, but there's another twist in the story. Because as he's talking about the person with the 20 million and the person with the 7 million, he says they go out and they risk all of that money. Now, it does happen that the guy with five talents, the guy with 20 million, makes another 20 mil. All right, same with the guy with the 70 pounds of gold, he makes another 70 pounds of gold. And in our American economy, we're going, yeah, entrepreneurship, good investments. But in the first century, those people, those two servants who doubled the money, the crowd knows that when the landowner comes back, they're going to get in trouble. Because in the first century, if you are fiscally responsible, what you do is you bury your money in the ground. You don't have any federally insured deposits in the first century. Banks are basically people who have set up tables and said, well, if you give me some money, I'll give you some back with interest, but you don't know if they'll be back the next day or not, and you don't know if they'll make interest or not. And so from the perspective of the economy of the first century, it's the first and second slaves who definitely are going to be just raked over the coals when the landowner gets back. But instead, he says, you were faithful with little. I'll put you in charge of much. Enter into your master's joy. Which must have really caused some scratching of heads, some questioning as Jesus tells this story, because they're going, that's not how it's supposed to go. Because the one person who did the right thing is the guy who buried his money in the ground. By the way, buy some land in Europe and just start digging. Right? There are a lot of people who were fiscally responsible. And these pictures here are of caches of Roman coins that have been discovered within the last 10 years. And that's not all of them. Farmers around the Mediterranean are constantly hitting bags of gold with their plows. Because Hiding your money in the ground was a safe way to deal with money, but if you didn't tell somebody where you hid it when you died, it just stayed there until somebody started plowing a field 2,000 years later. And the one guy who did what everybody would have thought was right is the one who gets in trouble. So Jesus, in the first story, tells us we need to pay attention to God's timing, not ours. But in the second story, he tells us, but God has given us things that we need to make use of. Not only just make use of, but just throw caution to the wind. Risk it all. Because what matters is it's not really about our investments, it's about God's power. And so in this interim, in between the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, the destruction of the temple, and when Christ is coming back again, we have a responsibility to make the most of the time and the most with what God has given us. Oh, and I know there's room for talking about being good stewards, but most often Christians use the passages about being good stewards to convince ourselves we shouldn't do anything at all. We're just putting our $3 million in the ground. Then the next story tells us what we should risk everything on. In the time that God is giving us until Christ returns, with the things that God has given us, risking them all, what are we supposed to be investing in? And Jesus says, you invest in people. And Jesus isn't bringing anything new here. He's actually taking categories of people that are found in Isaiah 58. If you're not familiar with Isaiah 58, in Isaiah 58, there are a lot of people who are really proud about how well they worship God. And God's response is, you call that worship? You go to temple? You do your Sabbath worship? You do everything decent and in order. You have the right type of leadership, the right type of music, and yet you're not taking care of people. And Isaiah, through the inspiration of God, says, don't you know that the real worship is how you treat God's people? What is more important to God than anything else are the people that he's created. And in the time that he's given, with the generous gifts that he has bestowed upon us, what are we supposed to be doing? We're supposed to be risking everything to help God's people, and not God's people who look just like us, but God's people who don't, the hungry, the thirsty, the foreigners, the poor, the sick, the imprisoned. The people who are created by God, who are being overlooked by human societies and human governments. Those are the people that we should be focused on, and our worship is worthless if it is not associated with the true worship of sacrificing ourselves in the same way that Christ sacrificed himself for us. This plays out in our daily lives. And one way or the other, we're probably going to have more opportunities for doing this. I don't know if you've been paying attention to what's going on in the current administration, and I don't care one way or the other about political parties. But what I am interested in is some of the people who have some sway right now in the politics of the U.S. are trying to get the government to pull out of social services. Right. These big cuts going on to Medicaid, the potential defunding of Social Security. There is a reason for those particular approaches, and that is because there are some Christians who feel that it is the church's responsibility to do those things, not the government's. And the idea is, if we can get the government to pull out, then the church can do what it's supposed to be doing. But my question is, if the church isn't doing it now, will we do it when we have the opportunity? But one way or the other, there are going to be, in the current trend, greater opportunities for us to pick up the work of Christ in the lives of other people. We're going to have to start thinking about how we help people in their retirement. We're going to have to start thinking about how we help people when they are facing medical bills and no insurance. We're going to have to think about how we help not just people in our congregation, but people outside of our congregation as they wrestle with these needs. The government got involved in social services primarily because churches couldn't or wouldn't. In the 1930s, the churches couldn't because of the Great Depression. And so a lot of social measures were put into place to take up the church's slack. Then in the 1950s and 1960s, with the Civil Rights Movement, the government stepped in when the churches wouldn't at all. They refused to recognize that all humans were created in God's image. If social services, government social services, are removed, it's our job to pick up the slack. And even with government social services in place, they are insufficient to help all who need help. And so the question becomes then, okay, I recognize that Christ hasn't returned yet, and it may be a while before he returns, and I recognize that God has blessed me with things, and therefore I should bless others. But have I recognized that what I should be focusing my blessings on, what I should be focusing on during this interim period of time, is how to take care of people? How to be involved in the ministry of Christ, who in his own earthly ministry focused on those who were sick and poor and foreigners, those who were being overlooked by both the political and religious systems of the day. Are we prepared really to invest in people? And do we realize that faith is more than just doctrine? I have a sneaking suspicion when Christ returns, he's going to find a lot of people who worship really well. And he's going to find a lot of people who police doctrines really well. And he's going to find a lot of people who at one critical moment in their life had a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling about Jesus. But the question is, when the Son of Man returns, will he find faith? Will he find us doing kingdom work? Will he find us being kingdom people? That's the challenge that Jesus raised 2,000 years ago, and every generation it remains a challenge. Because it is so easy to try and reduce our discipleship to something that's in heaven rather than something that's right in front of us. It's very easy for us to make religion about something that has to do with golden streets rather than asphalt ones. And yet Christ calls us to a ministry among the least of these. And until Christ returns, do you want to know where you can find the living Christ? It's in the poor, it's in the foreigners, it's in the imprisoned and the sick. Because when judgment comes, both the righteous and the unrighteous in the story Jesus tells are going to be surprised, but they're surprised because they didn't realize it was Jesus who needed that help. The Gospel of Matthew is about how God is with us, Emmanuel, but we also find out that God is with us with the poor beggar downtown, with the homeless man at the intersection, with the foreigners that are in our country. Are you willing to be faithful so that when Christ returns, he actually will find faith on earth? If you're visiting with us, or if you've been a member here for some time and you've decided this sermon has not been geared towards converting you to Christ, but we are here, and if you have decided that today is a great day to devote yourself to Christ and be baptized in his name, we want to give you that opportunity. So I'll be standing down here. You can come visit with me as the rest stand and sing.